Our next guest has written an amazing new memoir. It is entitled Porcelain. There were many reasons Moby was never going to make it as a DJ and musician in New York's club scene. This was the New York of drug-fueled hedonism and pumping clubs, where dance music was still largely underground, popular chiefly among working-class African-Americans and Latinos. And then there was Moby, not just a poor, skinny white kid from Connecticut, but a devout Christian, a vegan, a teetotaler. He would learn what it was to be spat on, to live on almost nothing, but it was perhaps the last good time for an artist to live on nothing in New York City, the age of AIDS and crack, but also of a defiantly festive cultural underworld. Not without drama, he found his way, and he tells that very, very compelling story in the new book, Porcelain. It is a memoir, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Moby to the roundtable this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. It's very nice to have you on the program. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. The first thing I want to mention is I love this book. I love reading this book. And I just want to make the point, because I think often when we see a celebrity biography, we assume someone else has written it. You are here to tell us that you wrote this book yourself, and man, does it ever show.
Well, the thing is, I didn't want to write it. I really, because I'd read a bunch of other music memoirs that had been ghostwritten, and I thought that would just be the most enjoyable thing in the world to, like, meet up with a writer a couple times a week, drink some tea, tell them my stories, have them write the stories, and then I could sit back and take credit for it. But then my publisher reminded me that I'm related to Herman Melville.
Yes.
And he sort of said it would be a hereditary affront to be descended from Herman Melville and not write your own book. And so I had to agree with him. And then I found out that I actually really loved writing. And it became almost like I felt as compulsive about writing as I did about making music.
And it makes for a very honest and compelling memoir. And you look at yourself through an interesting lens. It's very introspective and very honest, which is also rare in such a memoir, most times at least in my looking at it. Was there really anything, because what you have done in this book, I think it's important to point out, is you captured a time. You captured a good decade of your coming into your own.
Well, I mean, it seems sort of self-evident for me to say this, but the memoir is largely about me. But it's also very much about the, you know, life in New York from 1989 to 1999. It's about the evolution of this underground electronic music world and how it turned into something else. And I didn't want to just be this egregiously narcissistic, self-serving work, you know. And to that end, I wanted it to be very honest, or at least as honest as I could make it, and also to be about sort of like a broader historical, cultural context.
You came to New York City from Stamford, Connecticut, and you were making basically weekly trips to the city to do DJing gigs. At what point did you say, okay, I have to make the jump and go and be in the city?
Well, in the beginning of the book, I was squatting in an abandoned factory in Stamford, Connecticut, in the middle of a crack neighborhood, and I was making around $3,000 a year, and I didn't have running water, and I didn't have a bathroom, and I would sneak into New York on Metro North, sometimes hiding in the bathroom to avoid paying the fare. And then a friend of mine finally convinced me in 1989. He said, you know, if you really want to be a musician and you really want to have life as a DJ and someone who makes records, you have to be in New York City. And I didn't think I could afford it, because at this point in 1989, rents in New York were around $200 a month, and I didn't think I could afford $200 a month. But I struggled and saved and was able to make enough money to pay that $200 a month rent.
You make the point that these living arrangements were quite well, they were barely legal, really, right? I mean, there shouldn't have been a human living most places where you were living.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the abandoned factory. But the nice thing was that the abandoned factory was in a very violent crack neighborhood, so the police basically left us alone. Like, they had bigger fish to fry,
yeah.
Which might be a strange analogy for a vegan to make. But, the police would just sort of turn a blind eye to the fact that there were these squatters in this abandoned factory because they were, you know, dealing with people shooting each other and selling Class A narcotics. So, you know, a couple of furtive artists squatting in an abandoned factory didn't really register for them.
You write about your veganism, you write about your faith in the book, and when they were instilled in you in a fairly early age.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a vegan now for 28 years, largely because I just can't in good conscience be involved with anything that contributes to animal suffering, because I love animals. And the Christianity, you know, about halfway through the book, the Christianity definitely morphs into something, I don't know, different. And now I sort of self-identify as a Taoist, Sufi, quantum mechanics, loving fan of the teachings of Christ and fan of lots of other things. So I don't know if too many people would consider me like a big C Christian anymore. But it was very odd, you know, in the early days of the New York club scene, being a sober vegan Christian, you know, DJing at sex clubs and raves that were going until 8 o'clock in the morning. So my place in that world was pretty anomalous.
And this is not to say during those early years that you didn't drink a lot and have a lot of sex.
I eventually did, but I certainly had a period. Like, there was a time, you know, at the height of my serious Christianity, when I was dating a fellow serious Christian, and we would occasionally lapse and have sex with each other and then immediately pray for forgiveness afterwards.
And then you would be in a position again later on, and then you would lapse again, right? I mean, it was sort of an ongoing struggle, let's say.
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, I don't understand why I was being so hard on myself. You know, I was 21, 22 years old, and like 21-year-olds, when they date other 21-year-olds, are supposed to be making out a lot and not necessarily feeling guilty about it. But I've always been, maybe it's a legacy of growing up in New England, but I've always been really good at beating myself up.
And feeling guilty. And I wanted to ask you about this part of it, because you do give us a great, as you say, you're very, as I said, you're very introspective, and you do give us a really, I think, fascinating psychological portrait, really, of yourself during this time. So with that guilt, does that have effect on the music and what you want to create as an artist?
It does. I assume so. I mean, my goal as a musician has always been fairly consistent and simple. Is as a musician, all I've ever aspired to do is to make music that resonates with me emotionally, and then hopefully somehow will resonate with other people emotionally. And to that end, I guess it hasn't really concerned me too much what genre of music I work in, as long as it has that emotional core. And yes, I don't know that the guilt aspect, that's a good question. I think maybe one of the reasons I've loved making music so much is it's always been a sort of area where I could sort of put the guilt on hold for a minute and not, you know, I mean, still working under the assumption that I wasn't very good at what I was doing, but at least I didn't feel very guilty about it.
And I guess to me, in reading the book, I mean, without, you know, I certainly don't have a degree in psychology, but it seems that there was a purity there that you were perhaps aspiring to in your life, but that allowed you a purity in the music that you could do what you wanted without that guilt.
And I agree. And the thing that has always struck me as being really remarkable about music is that technically as an art form, it doesn't exist. And what I mean by that, and I realized this, I was working with Dr. Oliver Sacks at his Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. Mm. And at one point, we were monitoring how music affects people's immune system, their endocrine system, their, you know, neurology. And I realized all that music is air moving a little bit differently. You know, so whether it's a jackhammer or a cello, all that they're doing is pushing air around a little bit differently. And the fact that music can make us weep and have sex and dance and march into war and have these intense emotional reactions when it's just air molecules hitting our ears a little bit differently, it really, I think that's one of the things that has kept me involved in the world of music for such a long time, that sort of innate power.
You're growing up as an artist in this time where there is drug addiction and AIDS and mental illness and poverty all around you. And you're somewhat immune to that, it seems, just because you have a great work ethic, you're curious as hell, and you want to keep going and see what's out there.
Yeah. I mean, certainly living and working in New York or any big urban environment in the late 80s into the early 90s, it was rough. I mean, it was very dangerous and dirty, but it was also remarkable because it was very inexpensive. You know, so the New York of the late 80s was a place where any aspiring artist, any aspiring musician or writer could very easily live and pay the rent. So on one hand, it was less than ideal because every time you left your apartment, you took your life in your hands. But you were in this amazing community of fellow artists and fellow writers and fellow musicians. So it really was a very fecund time, you know, to be living and working in New York.
As a human being, and for you and for your mind, body, and spirit, it seems that it was easier. I think this is a good comparison, but you tell me. It's easier for you to, that struggle is almost easier than when you achieve success.
Oh, yeah, very much so, especially because I grew up very poor, and I had always seen myself as this kind of dysfunctional outsider.
Yeah.
And so living in relative squalor and actually being an outsider felt very comfortable. And when I started to have some sort of recognition or commercial success, it actually made me, it felt uncomfortable and felt unfamiliar, which might be why halfway through the book, you know, right when my career is taking off, I put out this very dark, difficult punk rock record that managed to alienate everyone. So maybe I was just sort of, I don't know, trying to create circumstances that seemed a little more normal and familiar to me.
And that point, and we're just about out of time, but that point where you say, all right, I'm going to give up, and then that's when even more success comes, and you say, okay, this is...
Yeah, at the very end of the book,
obviously
I thought
a sign.
My career was over. You know, I'd lost my record deal. I was battling alcoholism. My mom had died. I was battling panic attacks, and I thought I was going to make this one last record and then go teach community college somewhere in New England. And so I finished the album, and the book ends as I'm finishing the album, and it ended up becoming a very surprisingly successful record, especially because I thought it was going to be, you know, this obscure record that no one ever listened to.
And that, of course, was Play. And my final question to you, so I assume there'll be a volume two eventually.
I hope so. The thing is, volume two is sort of all the things that happened from 1999 to 2008, and it veers into the realm of cliche of like entitlement and alcoholism and drug addiction and narcissism and debauchery. So I'm just trying to figure out how to write volume two in a way that just doesn't feel hackneyed and cliched. Because there have been a lot of public figure musician memoirs involving entitlement and drug addiction, so I got to figure out how to write a new take on that.
Well, you've avoided it thus far. I certainly assume you can avoid it in the future. This is it's a beautiful book. You should be very, very proud of it. It is Porcelain. It is out from Penguin Press. Moby, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was a great pleasure talking with you.
A delight. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is Porcelain. It is published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.